This is Damien O'Doherty. We're coming to you from the Conference Call Podcast and the Lobby Podcast all at once. Thanks to our good friend, the chairman of the Advantage Foundry Network, Stephen Kuhn. He has a global CEO network that we've been talking about on Center Maryland for some time. And in my efforts to try to get Stephen on, he said, why don't you have our dear friend John Avalon on? I said, well, I got to do that. I got to take advantage of that. So let's just thank Matt Sitter and Stephen Kuhn for putting us on the phone today in this brief podcast with one of the best political analysts in the country and really one of the finest broadcast anchor hosts. That's John Avalon. You see him on CNN. The special thing about John is that he brings a sense of America that I think that few broadcast journalists bring to the game. And he puts it right out there in book form. He's done a book about George Washington. He's done a book about sort of the collapse of the political parties and an independent nation. He's done the story before there was even a Lauren Boebert. He did something called Wingnuts. But his most recent book, I think, speaks to his understanding of America, and the timeliness speaks to his care and compassion for this country. His name's John Avalon. He's a CNN host and anchor and our special author today of Lincoln and the fight for peace. Thank you for enduring that. Welcome, John.
Brother, that was very kind, and I appreciate it. Thanks, man. It's good to talk to you always, but especially here and now.
So listen. We have all these global CEOs listening because our good friend Stephen Kuhn has us on the case. Just real quick, Cliff Notes version here. We want everybody buying this book. My understanding was actually a bit of a shortage out there. People were buying this thing up so quick. You had a little trouble keeping up with the demand. But talk to me about what global CEOs, when they hear about Avalon, Lincoln, and the fight for peace, what's in it for a business leader and CEO?
Well, you know, I think all CEOs and business leaders ultimately should care about the study of leadership. And that sometimes is going to be narrow cast business leadership. And I've run a business or two, particularly when I was editor in chief and managing director of the Daily Beast. Actually, bizarre fun fact, few people know, actually have an MBA, not a degree in journalism. But I think the study of leadership and management transcends, you know, genres. And there's a lot every leader can learn from presidents, but particularly, I think, Abraham Lincoln. They're not the lessons that I think often get emphasized. One of the things that inspires me about Lincoln is that he had a collaborative leadership style. Most importantly, he reminds us that kindness can be consistent with effective leadership. And that's something we don't talk about a lot, but it's amazing how many generals, even in the middle of the war, William Tecumseh Sherman among them, commented that he wasn't only the greatest man they'd met, but it was his goodness that defined his greatness. And he practiced what I call the politics of the golden rule, which is treat others as you would like to be treated. And that is a profound, difficult thing to do. And I think a lot of CEOs often see their job as simply driving the bottom line. Certainly Abraham Lincoln knew how to get the bottom line done, you know, win the Civil War, win re-election, end slavery. But he understood the way you approach achieving great goals is essential as well. And because he tried to empathize with his opponents as a means of reasoning with them, because he didn't demonize people he disagreed with, because he used humor and spoken stories and parables to disarm opponents and communicate clearly to folks who may not, you know, be native to his, you know, the language of the law, which is what he was before he was a politician. All those things offer a lot of actionable insights. And that's what the war is. The book's not only about Lincoln and a portrait of his leadership as a reconciler in a time of radicals and reactionaries, but also about how you win a peace. And that, too, I think, has a lot of applicability because it's a matter of policy and leadership. And Lincoln set the mold, man. He just set the mold.
I feel like in this era of presidential biographers, you know, people like you and David McCullough have done an an awesome job of sort of taking the marble off the man, whether it's Washington or.
Well, I like that phrase.
Yeah, well, I'm trying my best here.
Are you in communications, Damon?
So, but I tell you what, the Lincoln experience, it seemed like he got that from the get-go in his leadership style. So while the warts and all biographies are a more modern phenomenon, it seems to me that he kind of offered up his warts when you first saw him or first engaged him. And he offered up a tremendous sense of humanity in the very short exchanges, you know, he would have with people. I'm wondering what you think of that.
That's a really interesting and an important point. You know, it part of his use of humor was self-deprecating humor. You know, he made a few mistakes as a young legislator where he made other people the butts of his jokes as a mimic and slid into mockery. And then he resolved not to do that. And he told a lot of jokes at his own expense. And you know, famously, I mean, one of, you know, someone accused him of being two-faced. And he said, if I had two faces, would I wear this one? And actually, it's just on the humanizing Lincoln part, it's a pretty good line. On the humanizing Lincoln part, one of the things I found fascinating is how many people, when they met Lincoln in person for the first time, wrote their letters home. They said something along the lines of, he's the ugliest person I've ever met. But then what was also characteristic is once Lincoln started telling a story or giving a speech, something warmed up in his features. And I think his soul started to shine out of his eyes and his countenance changed. And there became something beautiful about him. So it you know, Lincoln also possessed and used a sense of moral humility, which is different. It doesn't mean he wasn't ambitious. He had a modesty about him, a Midwestern modesty, but the moral humility is really key. Part of which is that he found human frailty both inevitable and funny. And if you believe in human frailty, it's a leveling factor. And then that can create a sense of moral humility. You know, rarely are people angels or devils. And they're usually driven by short-term self-interest and maybe a little bit of laziness and some desire for self-betterment. But if you understand human beings from that altitude, from that perspective, it humanizes the whole endeavor. And you know this, so much of politics is just interpersonal relationships.
Trust, and
you know, one of the things that I you take the marble off a man being a great phrase, you know, part of the reason it's more interesting, but also it makes their wisdom more accessible. And one of the things I tried to do in this book is I think we forget how often a person's politics and policies are a reflection of their principles. Yeah, it's true, but also their personality. It's a matter of temperament and disposition. And Lincoln's personality is really defined, I think, by empathy and honesty and humor and humility. And those qualities flow through. And what makes his moderation great, and I say that as a card-carrying centrist and independent, is that it's balanced with moral courage. And that's what makes it effective. And what he's really focused on is how you can achieve sustainable progress. He's very mindful about not going too far too fast. I found this quote from the Secretary of the Senate, a guy named James Forney, who was also a journalist, who at the time Lincoln was alive said, Lincoln is the great progressive of our age because he does not get too far ahead of the people, but he also pushes them just slightly. He takes advantage of events and therefore he is able to achieve sustainable change because he's mindful of the fact that if he goes too far or too fast, he could create a backlash. And I think that's a lesson of leadership, but also, you know, also particularly in politics that some of our Democratic friends could pay attention to at times in particular.
Yeah. One of the things he seems to evince throughout your storytelling is this, I guess it's sort of difficult to explain, but I think he shows that character really counts for something in a way that we all know it does, but we never want to admit because we can't define it. And I just love to hear your ideas about fidelity and loyalty and how he was able to play all these old time politics, but at the same time, bring a new vanguard of American thinking. It's like, you know, it's a lot of load to carry.
That is a lot of load to carry. And his nickname in the White House was the Tycoon, which I always liked.
Say that one more time.
His closest aides called him the Tycoon. And it was kind of an inside joke reference to the fact that he'd created this political empire out of whole cloth, right? You got to remember, he is a new president from a newly created political party. He's the first Republican president. It's really the only successful third party effort we've ever had in this nation. And it's a moderate progressive party at the time. It's a big tent party. And Lincoln gets elected with no executive experience, not a governor, he's never even been a mayor, no military experience. So he's able to really create, to your point, I mean, he's a politician, but he distinguishes himself and gets the nomination in Chicago in 1860 because he's seen as more honest and more moderate than some of the other leading candidates. On loyalty, I mean, you know, Doris Kearns Goodwin famously wrote The Team of Rivals, and it's certainly true that a lot of even his Republican allies were critical of him. They didn't think he was zealous enough, not radical enough. But he was sort of bemused by all that and focused on achieving great goals. He wasn't offended when people, if they disagreed. He took all that in the stride, with kind of a backwoods common sense. It's one of the reasons he used humor. And you mentioned, again, you know, the fact he spoke in stories and parables. That was a means of kind of defanging folks, disarming them, also communicating to common folks, you know, in a way they can understand, you know, whether, you know, it stems from reading Aesop in the Bible as a young man. So I think his political achievement can't be underestimated. It is considerable. You know, he wasn't loyal to a fault, by which I mean that, you know, he ditched five Union generals before finally meeting Ulysses S. Grant, who had a similar aggressive vision of the war. He changed cabinet officials.
Which is a bit of no fear of failure from a business. If you're a business CEO, there's certainly he had some gumption and grit there to cycle through new leaders till he found one that exemplified the path he was going to take.
What he was looking for. That's exactly right, especially because he has no military experience. And here he's leading a nation in a civil war. But he schools up. He goes to the Library of Congress and gets a bunch of books and develops his own theory and strategy of the war. And in the middle of the war, while he's encouraging his generals to be more aggressive, and that's the constant theme. He's frustrated at the fact that they haven't been aggressive enough. At one point he writes a letter to McClellan. He calls the Army of the Potomac McClellan's bodyguard. And when he says they need horses, they need reinforcements for their horses, you know, new horses sent in. And he says, I hope you'll pardon me for asking what you've done that might make your horses tired. Another time after... there's the failure to follow General Lee after Gettysburg. He is furious and he writes a letter that he never sends, blowing off a lot of steam. But no, I mean, he's refusing easy wins. You know, one of the key lessons in my book that I think is worth ruminating on is that he refuses offers of ceasefire late in the war. He refuses, even though that would have been an easy way to end the bloodshed. And there are all these people calling for peace at any price, but Lincoln realizes that peace at any price is too expensive. He says, you know, no man desires peace more than I, he says, but I'm unwilling to have a peace that, if so achieved, would only guarantee the more bloodshed and the new, by which he means if there's a ceasefire and then you negotiate the details of surrender, which is what was being offered, he believed that it would immediately reduce the political will in the North to end slavery. And that if you didn't end slavery, then you didn't remove the root cause of the war. And so he's thinking in the middle of the war also about winning the peace. He's passing legislation with Republicans in Congress to help create an economic boom westward after the war.
Right. You know,
Transcontinental Railroad, land grant colleges, Homestead Act. So he's actually thinking very much about economic expansion westward as a way to reunite the nation after the war, giving people a sense of shared investment, a sense of optimism about a shared prosperous future and moving people's attention westward rather than fixating on the north-south divides. So, you know, there's so much that's applicable from a leadership and management standpoint. You know, he found a guy who had his own vision of unconditional surrender followed by a magnanimous peace. That was Ulysses S. Grant. And he would fire the generals necessary to do it. He says, you know, stand with someone when they're right, part with them when they're wrong. He was frequently criticized, you know, from the radicals and the reactionaries. He suffered moments of doubt. He thought he was going to lose re-election in August of 1864. But you know, the thing about what he understood in his personal decency, which was so transformative among his closest aides, that reputation for kindness that they saw with their own eyes, is that he believed that decency could be the most practical form of politics, but he understood that people were more likely to listen to reason if they were greeted from a position of strength. So, you know, you had to win re-election. You had to win the war to get a chance to have that magnanimous peace.
I was laughing when you were at the Maryland Club, reminding everybody of that, because that sounds like our firm motto, which is I try to be as magnanimous as possible. But my partner, Steve Carty, reminds me gently that, you know, it has to come from a place of strength, maybe not from a place of weakness.
It's true. No, Steve's right. You know, but it's the balance.
Steve's always right.
You want to combine strength with mercy. And you know, look, I think, you know, one of the things, and this is, you know, a little bit in from team of rivals theory, but you also want to get people who balance your perceived strengths and weaknesses, you know? But you know, Lincoln was really a man of peace in a time of war. You know, he actually didn't particularly like interpersonal conflict. But he had a reputation for honesty that helped create trust. He was a good lawyer who preferred arbitration to going to court. Not arbitration, but, you know, just actually finding a way to avoid going to court through negotiation and negotiated settlement. So he really was kind of looking for win-wins. As long as the great goals were achieved, he didn't much care how he got there. That's another lesson I think that's really useful. You know, he was willing to negotiate every detail as long as the great goals were achieved: an end to slavery for all time, an acceptance of the federal union, and a renunciation of any right to secession. As he said, there can be no appeal from the ballot to the bullet.
Well, where I'm a professional counselor to CEOs, I think you did a marvelous job making up for my shortcomings and delivering that conversation. Well, I have you for just a couple more minutes. You know, you mentioned at the outset your work with the Daily Beast, which was really a first of its kind, groundbreaking news organization, all digital. You wrote a book called Deadline Artists, which folks can find online at johnavalon.com. You know that many of us in Maryland have been working with, and you've been kind to Stuart Bainum. I've been watching Stuart and Ted Vedatulis and our friend MTS Patel start a whole new news organization in Baltimore called the Baltimore Banner.
Yeah.
And I would just love to hear in the next two or three minutes, the last two or three minutes I've got you, I'd love to hear advice you have for the journalists in the newsroom, you know, the business and nonprofit leaders that got to make something happen there. Just any advice as somebody who's running all digital newsroom in, you know, Gotham, America. We'd love to pick your brain for a few minutes on any insights you could share with MTS, Stuart, sure, and our late great Ted Vedatulis.
Well, that's a whole nother conversation I'd be delighted to have, but a couple of quick things. I mean, first of all, we cannot overestimate the importance of quality local journalism, not only to our cities, but to our country. I think a high degree of the polarization and frustration and corruption and division that we're dealing with today are in part because we have seen local journalism wither and die on the vine in many cases and places. And, you know, if some of these sort of ultra capitalist, you know, hedge funds are trying to look for value creation in consolidating of newspapers. You know, journalism is a mission-driven business. And I have no problem understanding the business side, and more journalists should pay attention to that. But you need to understand the mission, and you need to invest in quality if you're going to find differentiation. And while legacy brands are great, I think it takes a lot of guts and gumption to create a new brand if that's not available and doing the thing it was created to do. And I think the key is for any news brand is leaning into your core differentiation, investing in quality, which means quality writers, some characteristic columnists who understand the community, people who can write with humor, who can uncover stories, but also, you know, your investigative unit as well as your rapid response team. You got to break stories. You got to break news. You also got to play a constructive civic role and be proposing solutions. Advance the conversation. That's one thing I think because of my background in government in my 20s is even as a columnist, and certainly, you know, as an EIC, you know, I'm interested in the solutions at least as much as the problems. Now, that's not everybody's, you know, everybody's deal, but I think it's really important from a civic standpoint and to build trust. And, you know, I think that's part of the mandate. So there's got to be an investment in quality voices, thinking constantly about the differentiation of the brand, a focus on scoops, but also a focus on investigations. You know, speed is great and a necessarily piece of the puzzle, but to really be valuable, then you gotta make it clear to people the value you're delivering. And then you gotta, especially when you're getting off the ground, you know, toot your own horn so people can see the work that's being done, because they don't have the benefit of bumping into your news.
Journalists hate doing that. Not till they discovered Twitter do I think the journalists understood the tooting of the own horn. it's a lost art.
It's also about the support, adequate support. You know, news businesses need to understand that social media is part of your marketing budget. It's not, you know, a place where you look for a traditional, you know, P&L return on investment. So, but because people aren't going to bump into your paper at the diner or the barbershop, that you got to get the word out in other ways and make people see the work you're doing and hire people who are breaking the kind of news or who have the kind of reputation locally that makes people pay attention. And, you know, a place like Maryland's great. You can cover the city, you can cover the state house. It's centrally located in a way that's really important. There's no shortage of great stories coming out of Baltimore and Maryland writ large. But, I'm hoping is that what that team is doing in Baltimore is something that, like the Texas Tribune and a couple of other successful ventures, is show that you can do local journalism in a way that can return the integrity and the vibrancy and the bounce to local journalism and keep people there, because without it, the decline in trust and the increase in corruption becomes palpable. You know, I always joke about this, but, you know, the Constitution doesn't mention political parties, but it does mention journalists and the work of journalism. You know, we're all human, and it's a human enterprise, and it is inherently flawed. But right now, because the business model of legacy brands is so terribly broken, we need people who you know, believe in the mission to roll up their sleeves and to help us find individually different models while redeeming the promise of local journalism in places that need it. Because without it, man, it's going to be a race to the bottom. We owe our cities and our towns and our states and our communities and our country back.
He's John Avlon. He's from CNN. And of course, you can read his latest book, Lincoln and the Fight for Peace, anywhere you buy books. But I encourage everybody to check out his whole list of publications because they're fantastic. And they really get to where America is about 5 years before we actually get there. So it's a helpful map for the future. Thanks so much for joining us on Center Maryland.
Hey, man, my pleasure. Be good, brother. I'll talk to you soon.
There just seems to be something about giving the worst question ever, John.